Support for this show comes from Slack. You're a growing business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
In general, I try not to look away from the problems in the world. I mean, I've built a whole show that really forces me to think about them. But climate change, that's a rough one. I think for most of us, not just for me. It's big and intimidating, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do about it, what I even could do about it. The whole thing makes me pessimistic about where we're heading. And as a parent, that's just not a place I want to be. So I distract myself. I try to avoid that dread. Every now and again, though, something comes along. A book, a movie, an essay that shakes me out of my stupor and forces me to think about something I don't really want to think about, but absolutely should think about. And when it does, I feel genuine relief. I'm Sean Elling, and this is The Gray Area. Today's guest is the writer Stephen Markley. He's the author of a recent novel called The Deluge, and it is one of those works that shook me out of a stupor. It's epic in scope, coming in at roughly 900 pages, and it's ambitious in its treatment of the entire climate problem. It's not exactly dystopian, and it's not one of those spectacular day-after-tomorrow-style disaster stories. Instead, it's a realistic look at the political and cultural consequences of living on a warming planet, told through the eyes of many different characters who confront the problems and experience the fallout in very different ways. And I'm excited to have Stephen on the show today to talk about his book and why he wrote it, my dread, what I should do with it, and what he predicts is going to happen to us all. Stephen Markley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Man, this is a beast of a book. Is that the first question every hack interviewer asks? How long did it take to write? Why is it so long?
I enjoy hack interviewers, so it's one of the top three.
And how long did it actually take to write? I actually really want to know that.
So I was working on it sort of on and off as I worked on other projects. I wrote the first chapter in 2010 and turned in the last draft in 2022. That is, 12 years of living with it more or less all the time.
12 years in today time is eternity. So that must have been a lot to keep up with.
Well, good stuff takes a while, I guess. good writing takes time.
But this story covers something like a 40-year window, and it starts around 2013. Why frame the story that way? Why start in the near past and end in the near future?
My conception of the book was always that it had to begin in our recent recognizable past and then elide the present moment, elide the moment of its publication, and pick up in the immediate near future and sort of extrapolate from there into where we're headed. And to me, this technique creates this very vivid, realistic sensation of living through the climate crisis. You're both having memories that you recognize appear in the book, and sort of our present day cast of characters is blending into the characters of the future. And I think that creates a really addictive sensation to the way the world operates in the book, to the world building.
You're a writer. You're not a scientist or an activist. But I don't think you write a book like this unless you really feel compelled to do it. Did you really feel like you had to write this?
Well, no, it's not like the climate crisis is like the 37th on my list of interests. I certainly view it as, and I think most people should, the defining event, the defining situation of our lifetimes, and not just our lifetimes, but our children's, our grandchildren's, and on and on. You know, to me, it was like, how could I not write about this? This is the most important and compelling thing that will happen in my lifetime. And from there, it was just sort of a matter of figuring out how to narrativize it, how to bring it into story rather than into sort of a polemic or a didactic instruction manual.
How do you balance your own political commitments with your fidelity to the story you're telling? Or is there even a tension there at all?
I think there is a tension. You know, making sure that every character had their own perspective and their own take on what had to be done, including extremism in some regards. What that does is it makes me as the author have to go into the headspace of those characters and discover them as I would discover anyone else, and really sort of stress test my own beliefs.
I guess there's been a fair amount of climate fiction in recent years, probably not enough. But what always grabs my attention is anything that explores the social and political consequences of climate change, how a steadily warming planet is going to torpedo are human systems. And there is a lot of that in this book.
Right.
Do you think people generally fail to appreciate this side of the problem?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the major disservices a lot of apocalyptic fiction does for this issue is to render it as, you know, the asteroid coming at the planet, you know, the all is lost kind of mentality. But really what we're looking at is just an ongoing sort of horror show, you know, a continuation and degradation of not just our climate, but also our politics, our culture, our sort of ability to relate to each other. It's frightening because it goes to the heart of like what we as a human community have been doing since we first stood upright. And I think that was what I was trying to illustrate in the book, was that this is not just about polar bears. This is about everything we've built, everyone we love, and everything we ever will love. It goes so much deeper than sort of those apocalyptic scenarios can even demonstrate.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a day after tomorrow style disaster story.
Sorry, but isn't it funny that that is so the example that comes up when people talk about climate fiction?
It's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Exactly, me too. And it's like that movie was so evocative in its failure. It sort of rendered the climate crisis through this, you know, incredibly insipid lens. Even though I recently was reading about, you know, the actual circulation of the oceans that in that movie produces that effect is breaking down, and it is kind of frightening. It still, I don't think, demonstrates for people what the stakes of this are. And in fact, makes it look silly. And I feel like a lot of climate fiction makes the situation look kind of silly.
Your book scares me more than, much more than a movie like Day After Tomorrow does.
And well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And like the real culprit in this story are these natural feedback loops that are happening in very boring ways. And like everything in nature, they're just totally indifferent to human life and suffering.
Right.
And like the book starts with this intro to this guy named Tony, who's, you know, the scientist. He notices something quietly terrifying going on with deposits of methane on the ocean floor. Is that actually happening right now in the real world?
Yeah, well, so methane hydrates are absolutely a real thing. They're deposits of methane trapped by temperature and pressure in these lattice-like structures of ice. They litter the world's oceans. They're everywhere. And if they start to melt, you know, there's a lot of evidence that that would lead to runaway heating of the planet that we would have no chance of controlling, and that would essentially make the surface of the world too hot to sustain life. So it is really terrifying, but that is just one of a number of these feedback loops. Scientists are doing a heroic job at trying to research where these eventualities might lead, it's all guesswork. If you really want to know anything about this, you know, go ask a fucking dinosaur. It's like nobody alive today knows, right? And so for me, it was sort of like starting the book off with like, here is the minutia of why this matters. Here is the potential demon we could let loose that we could never put back in the box. And there are a number of these things that are out there that we're only beginning to understand.
I think maybe somewhere in the middle of the book, there's a character who says something like, you know, it's wild how quickly you wake up and you're just in a bad movie from the future.
Right.
You know, like that's so horrifying to me because it kind of captures the reality that for lots of reasons, we're just probably going to go ahead and keep on sleepwalking into this nightmare until we absolutely positively have to confront it, which by then is too late to really do anything about it.
I you know, though, I think that we are closer to two kinds of tipping points, right? The first is the climatic tipping point and the human tipping point, at which point the damage from the climate crisis becomes irreversible and begins to crack apart our economic, political, and social systems, right? So that's what we're trying to avoid. But the second tipping point really is the economics of energy. Clean and renewable energy is coming along faster now than I ever thought would be possible when I started this book 10 years ago. Even faster than I thought was possible maybe 5 years ago. And so, you know, we kind of, at this moment in time, are sitting on this knife's edge. You know, people call it global warming alarmism, or I've heard that term before. But I think if you understand even the basic science, there's not really a way to be alarmed enough. Right now, we are in the fight of our lives to shave off the worst possible outcomes of the crisis, which is basically like, you know, the planet becomes uninhabitable, right? Like that's what we're fighting for now. And no matter what, we've done so much damage, we've released so many emissions that we're going to be going through this period of disruption to our weather, to our economy, that really will exist for the rest of probably the time you and I are alive. We are past the point of no return in that sense. And so now we have to figure out, first of all, how to stop it, eventually how to reverse it, and what we're going to do in the meantime in terms of adapting to a wild new world. But we still have the opportunity, and in fact, in some ways can catch up and get back on pace to keeping the world somewhere between 1.5 to 2 degrees centigrade rise over pre-industrial temperatures, right? And that is like what all of us should be working for with like every fiber of our being. It's hard to overstate just how much every tenth of a degree matters in terms of the chaos we're going to unleash. And this is, by the way, exactly what I talk about and sound like on a Bumble date. So it's like, I'm such a blast to be around.
Probably the most depressing single anecdote I've maybe ever encountered. And it was in David Wallace Wells's book, The Uninhabitable Earth. And it's something like, and you'll know if this is right, I think since like 1991 or 1992, we've actually pumped more CO2 emissions into the atmosphere than all of human history before that.
Yes.
Which is like, that is just an absolutely devastating fact to absorb.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because I think his line is that most of the damage done to the climate has been done since Seinfeld debuted. And so again, this is really the story of the lifetime of the people listening to this show. Like any millennial out there has lived through the failure of our politics and our economic elites to grapple with this issue. And I will also say that all of that damage was done because of concerted effort by the fossil fuel lobby to prevent action on this. You know, it's 1988 that James Hansen first sat before Congress and sort of said, holy shit, this is a problem. And our politics began to move in the direction of doing something about it. And then that concerted effort from the fossil fuel lobby forestalled it. So this is all not an accident. It has been engineered by people who want to continue to profit from the status quo on their way to driving our planet to the brink of destruction. And that's another Bumble date special that I pull out.
It's just getting happier and happier, even by this show's standards.
Yeah, yeah,
and boy,
yeah.
we get into the mug.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the book, because it's a great book.
Thank you.
You make a choice to tell this story through the eyes of like very different people. Why was that important for you to do that, to let the reader experience this, to view this through so many different lenses?
Yeah, well, I mean, I always viewed it as sort of this ensemble. You know, I wanted to see this crisis metastasize into the future through the eyes of a variety of people, including a character or two who does not believe it's happening. It was important to me to find characters that would each have a different perspective on it, and through those perspectives, create the human being who's going to carry us through in a storytelling way. And so that creates a little feedback loop between the reader and the character, where they're trying to understand this crisis through their eyes and get their perspective and feel their opinions about things.
There's a scene where Tony, the scientist, he is on a plane and there's some rough turbulence and the person next to him is scared. And he just very matter-of-factly says, oh yeah, yada, 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 climate change is altering the jet stream in ways that are going to cause more and more turbulence. And then he's like, yeah, eventually one of these things is just going to fall out of the sky. And I'm like, shit, really? Is that a thing that's going to happen?
Well, that's all about character, right? It's like this guy, Tony, is somebody who really sees the climate crisis everywhere. And so just, you know, you have him on a plane. As an author, you're kind of wondering what's going on. And then you're like, yeah, there's probably a shutter right now. And he's sitting by this woman and he's just going to say, you know, the least helpful thing to her he possibly can. And that's sort of the joy of writing a character is that when you know them well enough, you can kind of let go of the controls and let them just do what they're going to do.
As the storyteller, what's that imaginative exercise like trying to get in the heads of these characters who are different from you and doing it with real empathy? It's a testament to you. And I'm listening to these different characters and I'm finding them all authentic and persuasive and in their own ways.
For me, this is the way that I process the world around me. And part of that processing is trying to get inside the head of a make-believe person who nevertheless feels real to me and try to dig around and see what makes them tick. And then express that through their story. And so it's this imaginative leap. It's this act of empathy. The author, George Saunders, put this so incredibly well. So I'm cribbing him right now. But when I'm writing, I am like so empathetic and interested. And my heart is enormous for the world and all the people in it and what they're going through and all of that. And then as soon as I get away from writing my book, I'm back to being the same petty, pathetic person that I always am and walk around as.
But the fact that we have different people here grappling with this problem very differently, it makes me wonder who you think are the people doing the most actual good here. The scientist, the political activist, the eco-terrorist.
Sure. I mean, you know, within the context of my book, I think there's a pretty clear arrow pointing to who is the driving force behind making change. And I'm referring to Kate Morris, though she remains an incredibly imperfect person and character and makes all kinds of decisions that we would question.
Speaking of Kate, she's kind of the heart of the book, if the book has a heart. She's the leader of this climate activist organization, and she's a very charismatic person who becomes really the face of the movement. And there's actually a speech she gives early on in the book that really sets up the stakes quite well. And I think it'd be great if you could read an excerpt of that, if you don't mind.
For sure. We have a precious handful of years left to act, and I promise you this. If you do not join this movement now, you will wake up 10, 15, 20 years from now and feel sick that you didn't do everything you could during the sliver of time when we still had a chance, when we hadn't yet fallen over the brink. So what does that mean? First of all, forget about your carbon footprint. Carbon footprint is a PR term invented by an oil company. I want you to remember two words. They knew. They are the carbon majors, the 100 companies responsible for over 70% of emissions since the 80s. Their own scientists knew what would happen. They knew if they kept burning their reserves, they would threaten the future of the human race. They knew, and they built their oil rigs to account for higher sea levels and more intense storms. They knew and they told us to focus on our consumer behavior while they locked us all into structures of hyperconsumption. They knew and they waged a propaganda war of denial and delay. They knew and they're still doing it. There is no other way to put it. They are committing the greatest atrocity in human history, and they knew. They knew and they told us to worry about our fucking carbon footprints.
Thank you for reading that. And I have to say, just listening to it, it does kind of make me want to grab a pitchfork and break something.
Yeah.
Which I guess is the whole point.
Absolutely. And, you know, like if our politics and the media reporting on those politics were in any way sane, I feel like this would be the central story of every election, of everything happening right now. It is so wild. It is so outrageous. It just boggles the mind, right? It certainly makes me want to, you know, run out with my pitchfork as well, and has had for many years. But I think in terms of throwing paint and doing other sort of direct actions, we have to remember that just because you want to do something doesn't mean that that something is effective. We have an incredible challenge in front of us, right? And the tactical decisions made in pursuit of that matter enormously. I truly believe that the movement should be attempting to grow the tent as wide as possible. That particularly on the political left and on, you know, any part of the political spectrum, it has this innate tendency to become self-referential, to make the clubhouse smaller and smaller, to sort of go for purity over actually effectiveness. I really believe that right now the climate movement should be attempting to bring as many people into the tent as possible, even if we disagree with many of those people on many other subjects. It's too important.
Yeah, well, look, I'll hurl myself on that grenade with you if that makes you feel any better.
It sure does.
One of the more interesting subplots for me in the book is actually something you're getting at here. And it's this, you had this internal conflict going on within Kate's circle, and Kate is sort of like the leader of this group. And within that group, you had this kind of older, you know, grizzled white guy, politico type, and you have like the younger, more progressive activist type, and they're duking it out over how best to achieve the political goals that they share, you know, and one of them wants to compromise, you know, and for the sake of meaningful political success, and the other thinks that's a fool's errand and a betrayal, and you can kind of see both sides of it when they're making their cases. Do you fall neatly on either side of that?
In that instance, I'm trying to narrativize the political fights that are going to happen. I think I come at it from the most pragmatic perspective possible, which is, will this help us lower emissions as rapidly as possible? And we should look for the most effective policies to do that. Obviously, there are a trillion trade-offs. Climate politics are so convoluted and complicated, and you kind of have to be studying it all the time to understand even a fraction of it. And so I get that, like, for people who are busy, it's really difficult to sort of take this all in. But my overwhelming conviction is that the thing that matters the most is peaking emissions this decade and bringing them to zero as quickly as possible. And that should be our overwhelming focus.
When we get back from the break, Stephen tells us what it means to be optimistic and pessimistic in the face of a warming planet. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
The climate issue is something I don't want to say I just stopped thinking about,
right.
But there's a kind of cognitive dissonance, I guess, where the problem is so overwhelming and I feel so impotent in the face of it that I almost just kind of do forget about it for the sake of my own well-being so that I can get out of bed in the morning and feed my son. You know,
for sure.
But that is also sort of the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
The burying your head in the sand is maybe psychologically beneficial in the short term, but if enough of us do it for long enough, it's kind of suicidal.
Absolutely. And I think this is always a live wire debate in climate circles is like, should we scare people as much as we need to? Because then they despair and they stick their heads in the sand. And my conviction is also that you can't lie to people about how bad this is. Like, that doesn't make sense. It is scary. It is terrifying. And at the same time, again, I can't stress this enough. We have every technology we need right now to solve 60 to 80% of the problem very rapidly. We are deploying solar, wind, other renewable energy quickly now. The world saw renewable energy growth in 2023 that seemed impossible even 5 years ago. And it's only going to accelerate. So we have that part of the problem solved. The technologies that will bring us the rest of the way, those are going to be ready for prime time by the 2030s. And so really the only thing standing between us and reversing it is the political and social and cultural will to push forward as quickly as we need to. And so just when you're looking at your life, you're thinking about, you know, your voting, your political decisions through that lens of like, what is this person going to do about it? What is this city council member going to do about electrifying government buildings and schools, making sure enough EV chargers are available? What are they going to do about banning gas and new construction? All these little things that will accrue to what we need to do, which is, you know, electrify everything and crush demand for fossil fuels.
You have a mock Vanity Fair profile of Kate.
Right.
And she's sort of talking about the strategic need to transcend basically every other contentious political issue, right, from trans rights to abortion or whatever, in order to prioritize climate. And I get it, but also at the same time, it's like, but there have to be red lines, right? There have to be things that aren't negotiable. But I also get the perspective of someone who says, look, if the planet isn't habitable, then literally nothing else matters. So it's it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah. I mean, well, and Kate is a character who is sort of the embodiment of this is the wall. I need to charge through the wall. How do I get there?
And again, it's a credit to you that almost whoever's talking, I can find something persuasive in what they're saying. I can see it the way they see it, which either means you're doing your job as a writer or I'm just hopelessly unprincipled and persuadable, but I don't know. I'll go with the former.
Well, it could be both, I guess.
Maybe it's both, but it does speak to how agonizing, you know, some of these questions are. I think there are a lot of different ways to be a climate activist, but I think one of the central tensions is over this question of violence as a justifiable means to the end goal here, the end goal being, you know, making the planet habitable. I thought a little bit about this. I mean, I even had Andreas Malm on the show, the author of How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
Sure. Read it. Yeah.
And, you know, I still don't know what to think. I mean, I'm not a pacifist. I do think violence is sometimes regrettable and necessary. But like you, I think in the case of climate activism, it does more harm than good. Do you feel strongly about that one way or the other?
Look, let me put it this way. When I started this book and was much younger, and I think less versed on what we would have to do to get out of this, I was way more sympathetic to that idea. But over the course of the book, I had to actually do my homework, right? And I had to study social movements across history that have failed and that have succeeded. And I've had to look at the pure math of how we're going to get out of this enormous fucking problem. And when you start to look at all that, it's hard to see how we can bomb our way to installing heat pumps in people's homes, right? A lot of what the movement has been trying to do is to attack the supply side. But as long as we're all driving around, flying on planes, and the most pain is inflicted on the poorest people when oil and gas prices go through the roof, as we saw when Russia invaded Ukraine, it's really hard to beat this problem from the supply side, from blowing up pipelines, from destroying infrastructure. So even if you believe in your heart of hearts that's necessary, it's just difficult to see how that will actually work on a scale necessary. And then you look at the other hand, which is attacking the problem from the demand side, deploying EV infrastructure, heat pumps, solar panels, wind, all the boring shit that we hear all about all the time. That is actually how you begin to attack the problem and also sap the political power of the fossil fuel industry, which is really the most important thing. Blowing up their pipelines would not actually sap their power whatsoever. In fact, it would probably give them license to recruit people to their side, let's say, which is sort of how things begin to play out in the book.
Is there a group or a political movement anywhere that seems to you to be a kind of model of how to do this?
Yeah, look, this is going to be an incredibly boring answer, but it's the Biden administration. And I want to like pause just for a second and say,
oh, here comes the qualifiers.
In the 2020 primary, Joe Biden was not my first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh choice for the nomination.
Yeah.
I was kind of horrified when he won it. And I'm just so overjoyed to have been proven for the most part, entirely wrong about that. And I think this goes to like just the frustrating nature of our information ecology that the Inflation Reduction Act is not recognized as the enormous fucking deal that it actually is. This is the most important piece of climate legislation passed in the history of the world, and it's not even close. It's a bigger deal than the Paris Climate Accord. And if it's given a chance to play out over the next decade, it is going to lead to enormous structural changes in our energy system and our economy. I'm being a little glib here because it's not just Joe Biden. It's all the activists. It's Bernie Sanders. It's Jay Inslee in Washington, Ocasio-Cortez. It's all of these people who have been furiously saying this is the biggest problem we have ever faced. So when we look at what is changing things, it always goes back to these, like, this push of democracy forcing our political leaders to account. And that's what we have to continue to do.
You mentioned it there, and you mentioned earlier the media and, you know, the fake news articles in the book were amusing for me, partly because it speaks to how the kind of paint by number quality of a lot of journalism.
Right.
But is there an implicit critique of the media in the book, really the way climate is covered, the way it's prioritized or not?
You know, it's really hard to talk about the media as one overarching entity.
I try not to.
I fall into it all the time as well. But, you know, you sort of have right-wing media, which is its own entirely separate propaganda machine hard at work all the time. There's whatever is left of mainstream journalism, which is attempting to fact check and be responsible. And even then, the focus of a lot of outlets on climate is inappropriately sparse, let's say. And then you have the way most people get information, which is surveillance capitalism, the instruments of Meta and Google and Twitter that are, you know, basically just widespread ways of disseminating bullshit and making people believe things that aren't true. So, yeah, it's... Am I the cheeriest guest? I bet Andreas Mom was way more fun than me.
Usually I'm the one out pessimizing the guest, but you're giving me a run for my money here. I love it.
You know, I love a soapbox. I love a soapbox. So.
No, there's violence in this book, and there should be, because we're potentially headed for a world where there is less conversation and more violence because of the urgency and the disruption and the chaos. I mean, is that something you really wanted to hammer home?
Yeah. I mean, in my view, the violence in the book serves as a lens into the violence of the climate crisis, into the violence of what's happening. And that in order to make people feel the urgency, you need to understand the potential for what's coming. And is really already here. That to me was the way the book wasn't going to flinch. I was not in the mood to write something placid about this. I wanted to write a hurtling freight train.
There is this kind of tragic fact about human beings. Our adrenal glands are too big, our prefrontal cortex is too small, and when things go bad, fear takes over.
Right.
And that usually does not lead to happy places.
When you work on climate, you hear a lot of the same cliches from people, and they begin to like really add up and make you insane. But one of them is like, eventually there's going to be something terrible enough that we'll have to do something, some weather event, something, some cataclysm. And I'm like, what are you talking about? No, there's not. Like, that's not... First of all, the denialism's not going anywhere. We have to deal with it as it is. And second of all, what a cataclysm does to people is make them afraid and insular and causes them to, you know, focus on the other as the source of their discontent. No, we should be trying to forestall these cataclysms as best we can and not hoping for one to change people's minds.
This is the eternal advantage that fascists and authoritarians will always have, that when things are uncertain or are hard, it will always be easier to move people through fear than it will be to inspire them through hope. It's dark, but I really believe it's true. And that's not something that helps me sleep at night, I'll put it that way.
Trust me, I don't sleep well at night either. But I also think that when looking at a problem of that magnitude and this magnitude, and I believe the climate crisis and the rise of very frightening politics are deeply intertwined. But when looking at the problem, It does no good to panic about it. It does no good to, even though I do, it does no good to despair about it, even though I do. We have to look at the base of the pyramid. What are the blocks of this that we could begin knocking out so we can crumble the whole thing? And when you look at those components, and this was the joy of writing the end of this book, was that I began to interview and talk to all the people who are working furiously on these components. You begin to get a sense of what the future could look like. You know, I can, in writing this book, I can see the keyhole that we can squeeze through to get to the other side of this, and have a more just, equitable, and prosperous world in the process. Now, it remains just a keyhole, but it's open nonetheless.
You clearly did a lot of research for this book, and if nothing else, scanned a lot of the science and a lot of the literature. Did actually educating yourself in that way change how you thought about the problem? Did it change your perspective in any significant way? Did it change the story you were telling?
Yes, yes, and yes. You know, honestly, I think it changed my entire outlook on my life and what I wanted to do with it.
Holy shit, that's big.
Yeah, I mean, I just think at every step of the way, when this was just a kernel of an idea in my head, to actually beginning to write it, to, you know, the process of bringing it to publication, like, it's all been, you know, such a journey. There were points of writing this book when I was just suffocated with despair. Because, you know, if you educate yourself well enough on the problem and you can see the full extent of it and see the full scope of it, it is really frightening. And on top of that, I was writing this book and continuously having to change the terrifying things in the book because the terrifying things were happening in the real world too quickly. Literally, I would write a temperature record into the book that didn't seem like it would be achievable, and then it would have been achieved in the real world, right? And that happened with the political situation, with all kinds of warning signs that continue to keep me up at night.
But yeah, the whole events continually outpacing models thing is not super duper encouraging.
Oh my God. The example that I always think about is that Pacific Northwest heat dome from 2021. This heat descended in the Pacific Northwest that like incinerated whole towns in Canada. And this study that said, not only could this not have been possible without climate change, but it shouldn't be possible with climate change. So, you know, we're seeing events outpace what the models tell us is possible. And I think that is a super frightening thing.
After one more short break, Stephen talks about how we can still change course on the climate front. Stay with us. What is the importance of saying, as I have heard you say, that this is not something happening to us? It is something being done to us.
Yeah, well, I mean, a common refrain that fossil fuel companies must really enjoy is when a bunch of affluent coastal liberals go around telling each other what hemp tote bags they should be using. It's this idea that we are all doing it, that we are not born into structures, into economic and political systems that have us living like this. Like, those are all choices that have been made for us. And the fossil fuel industry knew as early as the 50s, but they really, really knew in the 70s. They had studies, they had Exxon had commissioned their own studies. They understood completely what was going to happen if they kept burning fossil fuels. Then they waged a propaganda war of denial and delay, as Kate said, in order to forestall any action on the problem. And beginning in the 90s, when Seinfeld came on the air, that problem grew exponentially. And now we're in this dire political moment, and these motherfuckers are still doing it, right? Like, they're still going around the country trying to fund these little propaganda groups in every town, in every rural community, all over the place, to forestall solar and wind farms, to keep renewable energy from coming online, so people will continue to burn fossil fuels, and we will continue to push the planet to the brink. This is not in any way a problem we've made. It's been done to us by an industry that is beyond criminal.
Yeah, I don't use a word like evil very often.
Sure, and I agree with that.
But I think it applies here. These are genuinely evil people who have done just unimaginable harm. Well, no, thanks to this book, very imaginable harm, actually.
Very highly imaginable harm. People are compelled to behavior by the incentives around them.
That's right.
And that's something we have to understand, is that nobody's going to change their mind about this. We have to change the incentives. That is like an overwhelming reality, that like, this is not about convincing people. It's not about convincing the Republican Party to see the light. It's about changing their incentives, how they get elected, who finances their campaigns, and on and on. Like, we have to look at the base of the pyramid in order to destroy the pyramid.
These are crude, silly categories in lots of ways, but I guess part of me just cannot help but ask if you are hopeful or resigned at this point. Because the book itself actually lands on a precipice of sorts, and that's, I assume, very intentional.
Yeah, I mean, I remain firmly clinging to my precipice. I go through these moments of, you know, that very familiar darkness where it really seems like the worst of all worlds is on the way. And that, I think, is unfortunately sort of the default mode when facing something like this, is to only be able to see that part. But again, I look around, and now since the book's come out, people have introduced themselves to me who are working on every single component of the crisis, who are dedicating their lives to it, whether they're, you know, engineers, activists, policymakers, writers, thinkers, whatever part of life they're in, they're doing something about it, even if that's just sort of spreading the word about what's possible. And I just think that's how everybody has to face thinking about this crisis, is what is the small area of my life that I control? What can I do? How can I be helpful? Thinking about furthering the solutions to the problem, approaching things with optimism of the will is vital.
Do you hold out much hope that there will be, I don't know, some kind of technological miracles that will just save us from ourselves?
Not at all. I don't think that is something we should concern ourselves with. I mean, if it happens, great. But, you know, I also am becoming more familiar with the potentials for wind and solar and battery storage, the potential for storing energy in our vehicles overnight to suddenly relax stress on the grid, of geothermal energy. There are so many different solutions out there. I was just listening to a podcast on enhanced rock weathering, which is basically a way of sucking carbon out of the atmosphere on a gigaton scale. Like, if we keep working at this, we are going to find solutions that right now look like science fiction or feel like science fiction, but will become a reality of our economy quickly. And so I don't think we need to look for the deus ex machina. We need to do the work and introduce the things we already know will work. Like, if we had 100 years, fossil fuels would be over, because all of this technology coming down the pike is going to be better. It's going to be cleaner, cheaper, better. However, we don't have 100 years. You know, we probably have 30, we hope. And so it's just the speed and the scale that we need to deploy this stuff is the difficult part.
If I squint hard enough and listening to you in this conversation, it feels like you have a very Sisyphean outlook, that the meaning is in the work here, right? The meaning is in the struggle, and we don't really know what the outcome is going to be here. And on a long enough timeline, we're all dead anyway. Like, all there is to do is just the fucking work.
You put it better than I could have. But like, for somebody who writes fucking 500 to 900 page novels, it's like, I don't have a choice but thinking about it as the work. Like, look at it like this. If 50 years from now, we have used this period in history to turn the corner on the climate crisis, and you and I and everybody listening to this was a part of that, that is an incredible way to spend one's life. Looking at this as an opportunity to do something momentous, to do something truly important, I think can sort of give us the energy to keep doing the work. But I think what the book also is committed to, and I was committed to, was that we don't actually know what's going to get us out of this. And we are going to make a number of mistakes. We're going to go down dead-end roads. We're going to fuck up. But none of that is a reason to stop or to give up. You know, I think that overwhelmingly is what is the heart of the book. It's the perseverance in the face of the impossible that drives these characters.
Well, like I was saying earlier, I struggle to really feel emotionally the stakes of where we are right now. It is
right.
It is just too overwhelming. And there's a quote from Kate's boyfriend, Matthew, in that mock Vanity Fair profile. I mean, he says, "I get why sometimes even smart people can't look directly at it. The implications are just so profound and frightening." But that is the value of art and fiction and storytelling.
Exactly.
It helps you feel the emotional stakes in a way that science and data and white papers cannot. And that is a real contribution.
Well, thank you. And I really appreciate that.
This is a monumental book and very much worth reading. And I sincerely recommend it to the audience. And once again, it is called Deluge? How do you say
it? I say I have always said the deluge, but then I hear people pronounce it
deluge
very differently, like deluge or deluge. And I'm always worried that I'm mispronouncing the title of my own book, but I think it's okay either way.
Well, once again, the book is called The Deluge. Stephen Markley, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
This episode was produced by John Ahrens, edited by Jorge Just, engineered by Patrick Boyd, and Alex Overington wrote our theme music. As always, you know I want to hear from you, especially in this episode, which was a little deep, a little heavy, but also a little fun, I hope. Drop us a line at thegrayarea@vox.com. Share it with your friends, rate, review, subscribe, all of that. New episodes of The Gray Area drop on Mondays. Listen and subscribe. The Gray Area is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep Vox free by going to vox.com/give.